This is a lecture on Racine d'Athalie, and accompanying it you'll find some PowerPoint slides which you can also refer to, and you'll be receiving a family tree in the course of the seminar, just to give you a little bit more clarity about who's who in the play and how they relate to each other. Okay, let's begin by looking at the background to the play first of all. It was first performed in 1691, so 14 years after Phèdre. Now, Phèdre was the last of the series of tragedies for which Racine was most well known, and the subject matter for these plays was based on subjects taken from classical antiquity. Following Phèdre, Racine had apparently retired from his role as a dramatist, and the reason for this is complex. The role had come to embody a number of tensions for him. Why? Well, one of the reasons is that he was one of the most famous pupils of the Port-Royal, and Port-Royal was a Jansenist religious community that ran schools and set a good deal of store by the value of education. Jansenism was a theological school of thought that followed the teachings of the Dutchman Jansenius. It was a Catholic movement, but it was one that had some similarities with Protestantism, in that it placed emphasis on man's need for grace in order to be accepted by God, and therefore man's utter dependence on God. This stood in contradistinction to a movement that was much more widespread at the time Racine was writing, and that movement was the Jesuit movement. The Jesuits were much more inclined to emphasise the role of good works in the process of man coming to know God, and they were much happier to link life in the world and engagement with the world with the process of following God's will. The danger of this approach was that quite worldly preoccupations could be argued to have divine significance, so that the focus on pursuing holiness might be lost in favour of pursuing individual desires. And Pascal famously satirises this tendency in his Lettres Provinciales, where he pokes fun at some of the desperate arguments of the Jesuits by which they justify rather unholy acts. This kind of false argumentation is known as casuistry, and it enraged Pascal, who was a committed Jansenist also, with important family connections to Port-Royal. Some critics, incidentally, have linked Athalie with the Jesuit movement and Joad with the Jansenists, and you can think of that a little bit more in a little bit more detail about that when you come to know the play in more depth. Now, Racine was educated at various Port-Royal schools between 1649 and 1658, and it's also worth noting that he would have experienced a rather different kind of education from that available in Jesuit schools at the time. The classes were much smaller. Jesuit classes were about 200 strong. In the Port-Royal, you'd have classes of five or six pupils. And there was in Port-Royal a general desire not to see the child as an unformed adult, but as a separate being, a kind of blank slate to be shaped in close association with the teacher. So Port-Royal was aware of the power of the teacher to transform and the nurturing role of the school environment. Port-Royal teaching placed more emphasis on reading Christian authorities, whereas the Jesuits often made more use of secular texts. And also, Port-Royal places emphasis on memorising and applying what one has learned. That his education had a profound effect on his life is clear towards the end of Racine's life, because he undertakes to write a history of Port-Royal at a time when the authorities were actually trying to close the institution down. So the Jansenist mode of thinking was clearly under threat. However, when he became a playwright in the 1660s, Racine severed links with Port-Royal and with Jansenism because they didn't approve of such a worldly activity as theatre and playwriting. Some critics, you may remember, have detected strong Jansenist tones in Phèdre, particularly in the play's use of the gods as a way of underlining fundamental human frailties. So it's after this point that Racine breaks with the theatre, marries a devout Catholic, and is appointed official historian to the king in 1677, the king's official historiographer. Some people attribute this change in direction to a renewal of faith, But it may also be the case that Racine had found himself a rather good alternative position as a historiographer, and that he wanted to adopt the role of a reputable courtier. In fact, it's worth noting that Racine did not lose contact with the stage entirely. He wrote official pieces for court occasions. He wrote pieces for festivities that took place at Versailles, and he wrote the libretti for a couple of Lully operas. When the king's mistress, Madame de Montespan, was replaced by the much more pious Madame de Maintenon, whom the king later secretly married, Racine was called upon to write for her. Now, Madame de Maintenon founded a boarding school for girls called Saint-Cyr in 1686, and this school was run along similar principles to those Pour Royal schools that I've just mentioned. Now, it was the case in schools in this period, particularly in Jesuit schools, actually, for pupils to perform plays. And Racine is commissioned then to write two plays for these girls at Saint-Cyr, and he produces two religious plays, Esther, published in 1689, and Athalie, published in 1691, as I've said. Okay, and rather like the form of the Jesuit plays that were written by schoolmasters in that environment, this is a drama with musical interludes for song and dance. Okay. Now, I've given you that kind of background on Racine's educational experience as a child, partly because it's important to know the influence of Port Royal upon Racine, but also because the theme of education is a dominant one, an important one in the play. And particularly, we might want to think about how the child that figures in this play is treated and educated. And you'll see listed at the end of the PowerPoint presentation a couple of references. The first of those, Nicholas Hammond, Educating Duras, The Power of Memory in Athalie, is worth a read on precisely this topic of education. Okay? So now I want to move on to looking at the play and just summarising for you the basics about background and plot. So, Athalie, then, is based on the story of Athalia, which is found in the Old Testament in two places, 2 Kings 11 and 2 Chronicles 22 to 23. Now, this was a new subject for tragedy. The theme had only previously been used for a couple of college productions in 1658 and 1683. Okay. So, who is Athalie, then? She's the daughter of Jezebel. And Jezebel is an enemy of the house of Judah. Jezebel worships Baal. Other important characters in the play include Mattan, who is the high priest of Baal and is very influential over Athalie. So the religious strand, the hostile religious force of Baal that Athalie represents is, as it were, kind of embodied and practiced and led by Mattan, the high priest. Okay, now Athalie at the time of the play was ruler over Judah, and she was a corrupt ruler. She'd converted her husband Joram of the house of Judah to be also a worshipper of Baal. When her husband died, her son Ochusias continued to worship Baal and defy the God of the Jews. So, in the background, as given to us in the Old Testament, God orders the killing of Ochusias, as well as the killing of Ashab and Jezebel, Athalie's parents. Athalie heard of this and was incensed, and as a result ordered the killing of all Ochusias' sons, because they were descendants of the line of David. Now, the line of David then comes through to the sons of Athalie from Joram, her husband, who was a member of the house of Judah. So effectively, she'd ordered the killing of her own grandchildren. However, Jezabel, the daughter of Joram by a previous marriage, managed to save one son, Joas, and he was given up to the care of the high priest of the temple, Joad, who was the husband of Jezabel, and he was hidden in the temple for a period of about 6 years. Racine has Joas aged 9 when he comes to the throne, but the Bible speaks of a 7-year-old. Okay, other characters in the play that we need to note are Abner, a political advisor to Atali, who is Jewish and who worships Yahweh. This is a character invented by Racine. Zachary, who is the son of Joad and Jezabel, and who features in the Old Testament accounts. And Salomit, the daughter of Joad and Jezabel, who is also a character made up by Racine. So you have a Jewish plot then, and this is somewhat unusual in the time, but it's worth noting that the play has a lot of plot similarities with Greek drama, especially Euripides' Ion and Sophocles' Electra and Oedipus Rex. And perhaps more significantly, Atali owes to Greek tragic drama Racine's use of the chorus to comment on the action. He doesn't use a chorus in other plays. And note that the chorus is not in Alexandrines, but in octosyllables, so it provides a lyrical interlude in the action in order to comment upon it. It's worth noting also that Atali adheres entirely to the unities and other règles. So the play isn't simply a Christian drama. It's a tragedy in the best tradition of Racinian tragedy, with powerful themes and tragic characterization emerging. So you might see Atali as the flawed tragic hero along the lines that Aristotle defines in his Poetics, for instance. Odette de Mour, an important critic of the play, speaks of two parallel dynamics emerging, a Christian pattern and a tragic pattern, and it's important not to neglect one in favour of the other. We have to see these two dynamics as both working to create the effective drama in this play. So the play itself then, having given you background to it, the play itself depicts the moment when Joad decides to reveal to the outside world that the rightful king of Judah has not perished, but is actually present within the temple and is ready to reign. The general knowledge that the rightful king hasn't been destroyed but is present galvanizes the Levites into armed action against Atali and her forces. Meanwhile, Atali agonizes because she comes to recognize in Joas her own flesh and blood, reminding her both of her own mortality and of her own troubled childhood. Joas also, of course, represents an extreme threat to her power. What should she do? To kill the child is complicated. And we see Atali troubled by the thought of this. Eventually, the outcome of the play is that the forces on the side of the child, so the forces of Judah, the temple forces, kill Atali. Okay, the next section of my lecture is entitled Tragedy in the Family, Forces of Maternity and Paternity. Racine points out in his preface that part of the significance of the restitution of Joas as the rightful monarch in place of his corrupt grandmother is that Joas is a direct descendant of the line of David, and it's from that line that the Messiah, Christ, will appear. So though in the biblical accounts, Joas does not stay loyal to Yahweh forever, and by Yahweh I mean the God of the Old Testament, because it was thus that he was spoken of in the Old Testament. So Yahweh then, the God of the Old Testament. As I said then, Joas doesn't stay loyal to Yahweh forever, and in fact, at the end of his reign, becomes corrupt in the manner of his grandmother. But nevertheless, it's essential to God's higher plan that Joas take his place on the throne at this point in time. And you can see Racine articulating the point in his preface to the play. He also makes reference, actually, to Joas's later corruption in the preface, so the audience can be in no doubt that the triumph of Joas's crowning at the end of the play is short-lived and somewhat ironic. So one of the themes of this play is that the force is that of the force of biblical history, the awareness of the fatherhood of God, who will eventually bring about the coming of Christ and human salvation, but whose ways and means of doing this are often hard to discern. Without Joas reigning on the throne, there couldn't be Christ. The line of David has to be pursued, and Joas allows this to happen. Because the ways and means of God are often shown in this play to be difficult to discern, trust and obedience are shown to be required of God's loyal servants. There's an image here of God as father, and a father who has to be cruel to be kind. So there's paternal order found in the inexorable march of history towards this goal. And it's a goal so far off that it's often difficult to believe in. So the larger cause of God, the larger cause of preserving the line of David, is important to uphold, but often difficult to discern in the present. Now, this paternal power is embodied by a number of characters, but particularly and most clearly by the character Ozuad, who is the high priest in the temple. He's a single-minded priest who believes that his duty is to uphold faith in the true God, in Yahweh, despite the trials being undergone by his nation. Of course, he has the advantage of knowing that Joas did not die, because he's the one protecting him. He's the one preparing him for kingship in the secrecy of the temple. So he knows, along with Jezebel, that the line of David hasn't died out already. And this is clarified in Act 1, Scene 2. He believes strongly that the line of David should be preserved at any price, and see lines 274 onward for this. And he rebukes anyone who's uncertain of the strategy of doing battle with Attali. He uses Joas as a means of flexing Judah's muscle, line 226. He believes in God as a God of vengeance, line 229. But he also believes that God is a good father to his own people, line 265. Joad then has educated Joas in the temple without revealing his identity to anyone except his wife. So Joas himself, and Joas is known as Eliasa at the beginning of the play, Joas himself doesn't know that he is the rightful heir to the throne. He finds this out in Act 14 2. Now this child is schooled by Joas entirely for the role of king. He's read the book of the law. He's eloquent in defending it in Act 2, Scene 7. He's therefore ready, at the point that the play opens, to take on the mantle of kingship as soon as Joad says the word. Joad's character then is seen by some modern critics as that of a brainwasher. He exclusively schools Joad in the art of kingship, according to the model of the temple, and will accept no other influence upon him. Now Abner might also be said to incarnate to some degree the idea of the paternal. He's less single-minded than Joad, but once he discovers who Joas really is, he is ready to take up arms against Attali for the Jewish cause. Mattai is an interesting character. As we mentioned, he's the high priest of Baal. He's a very determined character, something of a parallel to Joad, in fact, but acting in the cause of Baal. He wants the child killed as soon as he knows of his existence, because he understands that that the child is a threat to him. And it's Attali, in fact, previously so decisive in destroying her own grandchildren, who equivocates about this child that she sees. So Matan, decisive, wants to take action, wants to preserve the cause of Baal at any price. If we want to think about something, the forces of maternity in the play, we would in the first instance turn to the character of Jezebel. She represents the good mother figure who works in the cause of God. She saved Joas. She's acted as the prime maternal influence in his life throughout the play. Okay. It's interesting, though, that much as other mother figures in Joas's life, his real mother, his wet nurse, Jezebel's power over her surrogate son wanes in the face of his patriarchal destiny. Once he becomes the property of the temple, her desires to care for him and protect him must be secondary to his preparation for kingship. She wonders whether her husband has chosen the right time to reveal Joas's identity. She fears for his safety, as a good mother should, at 1 Scene 2. And she finds herself in conflict with the paternal ideals of obedience and trust that her religion holds sacrosanct as a result. So her faith is tested as a result of her maternal instincts. And we see her opposition to her husband articulated most clearly when she wants to preserve the safety of her child, her surrogate child, whilst he wants to put him forward as a means of taking violent action in order to destroy Attali. Let's also mention the choir. The choir largely acts as an antidote to the rather vengeful view of God put forward by Joad. The choir has the long view. It sings of the ultimate destiny of the Hebrew nation and of God's loving kindness in the manner of the Psalms in the Old Testament. They reinforce the sense that the violent struggle between Athalie and Joad is ultimately a struggle for good, guided by the hand of a beneficent God. Let's now think about the central character of this play and Athalie. Is she friend or is she foe? How are we encouraged to feel about her? Athalie's presence as a force of opposition to the purposes of Judah is evident from the outset. She combines treachery as an enemy of the Jewish people with a threatening femaleness that seems to offend many aspects of the Jewish faith. The first reference to her in the play is a reference to une femme who offends the religion of Yahweh. Her femaleness causes her to be seduced by Baal and also to be jealous of Jezabel, the good and obedient woman. Rather like Cleopatra in Rodogune, she doesn't appear until Act 2 and is then and then appears by committing the act of profaning the temple by entering the parts of it that were forbidden to women. And the temple, in fact, has to be cleansed after her actions. Defying the sanctity of the temple also occurs at the end of the play when Athalie walks into an ambush in the temple space. Note that she's removed from it before she's killed. So she's a kind of unclean presence, in part because she's a hostile force and in part because she's a woman. It's also worth thinking about the role that the temple plays in Athalie. It gives the play a sense of unity and the unity of place, but its significance might be rather more than that. And we'll think about that in seminars. Whilst we know all this about Athalie, it's clear also that the drama of Athalie's suffering is a drama that's not entirely of her own making. God, through Joad and to some extent Joas, has chosen to take her on so that her powers to avoid a showdown with Yahweh are weakened. And it's worth noting this about Athalie before we condemn her as an enemy. Out and out. If you look at Act 2, Scene 5, following the initial bloody acts in killing her grandchildren, which were a response to the bloody acts of Yahweh, who killed her mother, following this, Athalie has instated a peaceful reign in Judah. Into this peaceful reign comes the disturbance of a dream. Her mother, Jezebel, warns her in this dream that Yahweh has come to do battle with her. Now here, Athalie is reduced to the frailty of a child herself. She sees in the dream her mother's dead and battered body. She has no recourse to the comfort of her mother. She clearly longs for it at this point. Then in the dream, a child appears to her, to whom she's attracted. But the child then stabs her. Following this, Athalie feels drawn to the temple and believes that she sees the same child in the temple. So after the dream is completed, Athalie finds herself having to visit the temple space and sees Joas there. Joas then is the same child that she's seen in the dream. In Act 2, Scene 7, she encounters the child again and similarly feels moved to pity. One critic has argued that Athalie sees herself in the child. And because of this, she speaks to him on the level about his likes and dislikes. She wants to offer him the attractions of her palace. So she wants to offer him a much more pleasant living environment than the austerity of the temple. The real child doesn't correspond to her image of him, though. He's already much more mature than she expected. Is he, in fact, more brainwashed? He doesn't seem to speak so much the language of a child as the language of the temple and the language of God. And you see this in line 700 onwards. So one can wonder whether Athalie is looking for another response to the suffering that she's experienced at the hands of Yahweh and hoping for this other response to come forward in the child. It's worth noting that the whole dream sequence is invented by Racine. It's not there in the Old Testament sources. So this emotional vulnerable side to Athalie is something that Racine introduces us to. So unlike Matin, Athalie is loath to kill the child because she's intrigued by him. When she discovers his true identity, in Act 5, Scene 5, she feels betrayed by the Jewish God and recognises that there is no escape from his clutches. Line 1768. Just before she dies, however, she curses the child and his kingship. And it's interesting that her curse proves as true as Girard's triumphant proclamation of the power of God at the end of the play. Girard will indeed reign well, but then he does become corrupt. So the promise of the Jewish God is ultimately shown to be worth no more than the promise of Athalie, outside the boundaries of the play, if you like. So what do we make of this? Racine tells us that this will happen in his preface, so we know that this is a kind of shadow. We know that this is a prolongation of the difficult story of the forces of Judah and Yahweh against forces of evil embodied in Baal. So as theatre goes, we're prompted to try and make something of this, I think. Odette de Morgues' perspective is helpful here. She says, in the tragic pattern, God appears cruel, unfair, and moved by an arbitrary wish to destroy Athalie. Okay, just say that again. So the quote runs, in the tragic pattern, God appears cruel, unfair, and moved by an arbitrary wish to destroy Athalie. So what de Morgues is saying here is that the religious story is a successful one, if you like, in that at the end of the play, Girard ascends to the throne, and ultimately we know as Christians that the line of David is preserved through to Christ, and therefore the salvation story for Christians is a successful one. But if one were to look at the play on a tragic level, one would see God as a rather arbitrary force, taking hold of, controlling, and ultimately destroying Athalie. So we have two violent, unpredictable, and dubious forces at work in this play. Because of this, we may feel that some of our sympathies lie with Athalie, because she cannot compete with a rather arbitrary destiny. And this is really at the centre of the play's meaning, what makes it exciting as a play. This question of how we should interpret the play is intimately connected, I think, also to the images of maternity and paternity within it. You'll see if you look at your PowerPoint presentation that I've ended the lecture by just giving you a quotation from Athalie to Josabé. Okay. Sa mémoire est fidèle, et dans tout ce qu'il dit, de vous et de Joad, je reconnais l'esprit. Voilà comme infectant cette simple jeunesse. Vous employez tout de le calme où je vous laisse. Vous cultivez déjà le haine et la fureur. Vous ne leur prononcez mon nom qu'avec horreur. Josabé, peut-on de nos malheurs dérober l'histoire? Tout l'univers les sait. Vous-même en faites gloire. Now it's interesting to see the different ways in which this scene is read. Let's start with Nick Hammond's perspective. He reads this scene as one in which Athalie tries to get Girard to lose his memory of the Jewish God that he's been so lovingly taught by Girard, because memory is the one thing that allows the faithful to keep the faith. Without the capacity to recall Jewish traditions and to live by them, Girard becomes nothing but a child. Josabé accuses Athalie of using that Jewish history to gain glory for herself. But, Hammond speculates, Joad could be accused of doing exactly the same thing. So in tragic terms, two similar but ultimately uneven forces are pitted against each other. Hammond argues that Racine's God is in the end presented as the more powerful, but that Racine fails to give any account of why he should be more respected. The play thus remains profoundly ambivalent. It doesn't really privilege the patriarchal order over the maternal one convincingly. Helen Bates McDermott sees the speech in her article Matricide and Filicide in Racine's Athalie, which also you've got listed on the slides. She sees the speech as evidence of Joad's dubious motives. Racine tells us through Atterley that the child has been indoctrinated and therefore cannot behave like a child. And she argues this, and I quote, "The tragedy of Atterley lies in the sacrifice of the female stroke child, that which defies the law, to the male stroke parent, the law." So the tragedy of Atterley lies in the sacrifice of the female stroke child, that which defies the law, to the male stroke parent, the law. So she wants to argue that there is an issue of gender here. And she goes on to suggest that Racine may not be being intentionally feminist, but that he does present maternal values as potentially redemptive in encouraging us, by his presentation of Atterley, by her vulnerability, to feel some sympathy for her. And it's very interesting to note that critics in different generations with different attitudes to the Christian faith have argued long and hard about the message of Atterley. Our task, I think, is to examine how images of filicide and matricide, how the themes of maternity and paternity might inform our reading and interpretation of it. And one other dimension of the play that you can investigate in your own time is the question of the presence of the child on stage, because the very fact that a child appears on the stage in this play is unusual, is different and is new. And if you go to the bibliography under Atterley, you'll see that there are a number of critical articles that look at this. And it's a line that's interesting, partly because it's worth thinking about the value of having the child on stage. What role does Duras play? Does he really behave in a childlike manner? Is he something of a figurehead for ideas rather than the embodiment of a real and plausible child, for instance? Okay, that's all I want to leave you with now. We'll pick up a number of questions in the seminar once you've had a chance to read and digest the play yourselves. And you can find the seminar worksheet on the forum. And you can also pick up the PowerPoint slides, which will be attached alongside the podcast.